Whipped slate landscape of Nephril, Bryn couldn't see anyone. Not a soul waited. No one looked for their return. Why bother? No one ever returns from the abyss. If the Queen had stationed someone to keep a lookout on that far side, where the broken tongue of the bridge stuck out at the Ellison Pillar in a most insolent manner, they would certainly see her. Bryn was as bright as the sun at midday, and there was no way to hide. As it turned out, no one was watching. Wouldn't have mattered if they were. Bryn had no fear of being spotted. She was just a few steps away from the gate. Having ejected the last of her weight, Bryn knew she could cover that distance in less than an instant. Looking back at the missing section of the bridge, she also realized she'd have no trouble leaping over it. I bet I could run the whole length of Nephril in the blink of an eye. But that was for later. Turning, she faced her future. The gate to Ellison was visible, a shimmering light inside a cave. The twinkling beckoned her with its beauty, and she walked inside. The door was smaller and narrower than those leading to Rell and Nephril. She wondered if it was because getting in here was harder. She couldn't see anything through the opening except light. As Bryn approached, she squinted from its brilliance. Coming closer, she spotted movement. Someone was coming toward her, approaching the door on the far side. She was a wondrous being of radiance and power, dressed in fantastic armor. The person wore no helm, revealing long hair that cascaded over her shoulders. An amazing woman, with a fierce, determined look and sad but serious eyes. This was no one to trifle with. In all her underworld travels, Bryn had never seen the like of her before. Impressive was too small a word. Am I looking through the doorway and seeing one of the heroes who dwell in paradise? Or is this another of the gods? The woman who had been walking toward her stopped when Bryn did. Bryn raised a hand to wave. So did the woman. Dear mother of all, that's me. The light didn't come from the other side. The brilliance was her own. The door was a mirror. Bryn's Ashim armor, which couldn't exist in the abyss, had returned, more beautiful than before. And that wasn't all. Staring at herself, she noticed something strange. She could clearly see the key dangling from her neck, but Bryn reached up, and the key wasn't there. Not exposed, at least. It remained tucked under her shirt, which was now beneath the grand breastplate. But in the mirror, she could still see it hanging on the outside. The door to Ellison knew. Bryn reached out and touched the mirrored surface, but felt nothing. Her hand passed through. I guess I just need to have the key. She drew back and stood for a time, staring at herself, at that impossible image. She appeared like a Crimble queen, a goddess. Is that really me? Or an illusion I've invented? Bryn looked into her own eyes. Mirrors within mirrors, going on to infinity, into an abyss deeper than the one she'd climbed out of. Or is this the real me, and the other an illusion? She found no answers, just more questions that, like the reflections in her eyes, multiplied upon themselves. Maybe the answers are on the other side of the looking glass. With that thought, Bryn stepped through. Before she looked, before she opened her eyes, she heard music. The delicate plinks, plunks, and quivering strings of instruments filled her ears. Warmth was on her face, a breeze, cool, sweet, and filled with the smell of spring flowers greeted her. She didn't want to look. Nothing could match the beauty she imagined in her mind, grown from the sounds and smells. A paradise. A perfect place. Because Rel and Nephril had been so terrible, she knew this, too, would disappoint. Alison would end up being a place of lost hope, of false dreams, and... Bryn? She opened her eyes. The first two things she noticed overwhelmed and surprised her, but in retrospect, neither should have. Color was the first. She'd grown so used to the fiery red of Nephril's battles and the black and white dullness of Rel that the sudden abundance of greens, blues, browns, reds, and purples staggered her. Bryn's second thought was far simpler.
Wraith?
Welcome, Wraith said. He didn't look the same. Sort of, but not quite. Years had passed since she'd seen him last. Some differences would make sense, a few more wrinkles, perhaps. But Wraith didn't look older. If anything, he looked younger. There was more color in his face. Or maybe she was just obsessed with color now that it was back. The weariness she'd always associated with his eyes was missing. That was it. He stood straighter, and there was a smile on his lips. Have I ever seen Wraith smile before? The big Dorian was dressed in a long beige shirt, the sort of garment one might sleep in, except that it had a belt made of white rope. Although the shirt was of excellent quality and made from an amazing material, the style and simplicity resembled the clothing of someone who was poor, certainly when compared with how elaborately people dressed in Nephril, or even in Alan. Welcome to Alison, he repeated, extending his arms. She felt like she'd just crossed a desert, and he was holding out a bucket of water. To someone fresh from the abyss and starved for kindness, comfort, help, and hope, he represented a refuge from an unforgiving world. She threw her arms around him, and Wraith caught her. She reveled in his embrace, strong, friendly, and familiar. Since leaving the dragon camp, she'd done her best to be steadfast. She couldn't cry in the swamp, express terror as they marched to battle, or scream at the other's resignation in the abyss. And she certainly couldn't allow herself a moment's worth of self-pity while climbing the pillar. But all that was behind her. This was Wraith, and she could surrender to him.
I'm the only one. The only one left, she cried.
It didn't matter if he understood or not. A dam had burst within her.
I had to leave them behind. Every last one. Moya, Tikchin and Rain, Gifford and Roan, Tressa and Tesh. Oh, grandmother, I abandoned him. I left them all in Nephril, most of them in the abyss. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I failed them, and I don't know if I can do the rest by myself.
It's okay, Bryn. Wraith held her tight.
Shh.
Hush now. It's all right.
But you don't understand. We were supposed to come through together, but I'm all that's left. I don't think I can do it. I don't know how. It's all so hopeless, and everyone will die for nothing. It'll all be my fault.
You're here, Bryn. You made it out.
But I wasn't even supposed to go. It should be Gifford standing here, or Moya, or even Tressa. Anyone but me.
Wraith smiled at her, and in that look was both pride and a dash of amusement. Oh, Bryn, this has always been about you. This is your destiny, and it has been from the start. Don't you see that? Before the war, before I came to Dol Ren, everything has been about you. And it will continue to be long into the future.
What? No. You don't understand.
Yes, I do. We all understand. Trust me, we do. His big hand was on the back of her head, gently holding her as she cried. Then she lifted her face out of his chest.
We?
Wraith nodded.
Who are you talking about?
She wiped her eyes clear and looked around. They were on a broad dirt trail that led through a lush land of forest and field. Gentle green hills, dappled by golden light, made waves across a lovely valley of lush grass and wildflowers. In the distance were blue mountains, with a matching sky overhead.
It's beautiful.
You should see it on a nice day. Bryn took a step forward and peered up at the clear sky. No sun. No ball of light, at least. But a beautiful radiance did shine down.
This isn't a nice day. What's wrong with it?
We'll get to that later. Wraith placed his hands on her shoulders. You're taller than I remember.
I grew up.
He made a disapproving sound in his throat. You should try to avoid that in the future.
Well, I'm dead, so that shouldn't be too difficult.
Perhaps. He offered her a wink and a smile. But for now, I want you to look down that path and take a deep breath.
Why? We don't need to breathe, right?
She heard him sigh.
I don't remember you being so quarrelsome.
I told you I grew up.
Just do as I ask.
Bryn drew in a deep breath, and her eyes went wide. After her climb, she'd thought all her burdens had been discarded. They hadn't. For as she breathed, she felt all the hidden apprehension and fear she still carried in the tiny pockets of her soul fall away. The weight she'd unknowingly carried from one side of Nifril to the other, and the burden of leaving everyone in the abyss, slipped from her. Light didn't describe the sensation of buoyancy she felt. The closest thing she could compare it to was being tossed high into the air on a big cloth, stretched taut by members of Dol Ren during summer celebrations. Up she'd flown, her stomach rising, and she had felt a giddy, tingling sensation that left her laughing. That rush, the same wonderful feeling, surged through her now. She was high in the air, caught at the apex of the toss. That perfect moment of exhilaration that she only had glimpses of when in Alan. Here, she rode that single note as it stretched and lingered.
A note? Yes. That's what this is. Everything is music. Not just the sounds, but the light, smells, and sights.
Everything was woven together into a perfect tapestry of music. The droplets of dew, the breeze in the branches, the quiver of petals on flowers. She looked at Wraith and saw him smiling back again. My first day, I did a jig. She offered him a skeptical smile. Expressions of joy aren't something to be ashamed of, especially not here. In Alan, if you enjoy a good meal, you belch. It's how we express appreciation to the cook. In Alison, dancing, singing, and laughter are like that. He took her hand and pulled. Come. There are a few people who want to meet you. More would have come, but time is short, and you'll need to hurry.
People want to meet me?
Bryn asked, confused.
Who?
You'll see. Wraith led her up the path into the light, which, unlike the light of Rel, gave warmth. They jumped a fallen log and walked past a little hill where an orchard grew. Red, yellow, orange, and green fruits dangled from the branches. A few had fallen to the hillside and rolled down near the path.
Can you eat those?
Wraith glanced over. Of course.
What do they taste like?
Whatever you want them to. Bryn laughed.
But Wraith didn't. You're serious?
Try one. Bryn snatched up a perfectly round orange thing with a smooth skin and no stem. Do I just bite into it?
Do whatever you like. It's your fruit.
Bryn licked it. Sweet, like honey. She took a bite and was shocked when a flood of juice ran down through her fingers. It made no sense, but the orange ball, the size of an apple, tasted like a blueberry. And it was the sweetest, most luscious berry she'd ever eaten. This is fantastic!
Usually are. People generally don't choose things that taste terrible.
Around the bend was a quiet pond in a lovely field. To one side was a great tree that looked like a massive oak. Friendly branches spread out over three figures, each a woman.
Allow me to introduce you.
Wraith spread out his hand.
Bryn, Keeper of Ways of Clan Wren, meet Glyndora Fane.
He gestured to the first Frey Bryn had ever met who wasn't dressed in either shimmering cloth or bronze armor. She wore a simple ankle-length pullover dress of light blue. In her hands were the makings of a basket. She smiled and nodded gently in greeting. So pleased to finally meet you. How could a Frey in Alison know I exist? And why would she be waiting to meet me?
Glyndora is, Wraith began,
an excellent basket weaver. The Frey interrupted him and smiled. So I see, Bryn replied. Nice to meet you. My mother was a weaver too, of wool, mostly. Glyndora nodded. And a fine raiser of daughters, apparently. She grinned at the others, who laughed. Is there... Bryn paused. I feel like I'm missing something.
Not at all, child, Glyndora said.
We're just so excited to see you, mentioned one of the two remaining women, who stood up and grinned in amazement. The woman was small, delicate, and so young. Not much more than a girl. Isn't she something? Do I know you? Bryn asked. The woman was familiar. Her smile, eyes, and the sound of her voice tugged at Bryn's memory. My name is Arya, she said. I believe you know my son, Gifford. You're Arya? Bryn clapped her hands to her cheeks, then foolishly looked behind her down the path as if Arya's admission would somehow summon forth her son. But of course, he wasn't there. Cruel sadness followed. Oh, grandmother of all. Tears filled her eyes. Light as Bryn was, her legs gave out and she fell to her knees. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. Gifford, your son, he was with me. He could have... I know. Arya knelt down and took Bryn's hands. Her touch was, the only way Bryn could describe it, was magical. Instantly, she felt better. While alive, Bryn had never met Arya, but everyone in Dol Ren who had spoke highly of Gifford's mother. Although she died when not much older than a child, she was a hero to the clan. Her whole life had been lived fearlessly. She had been the last to take and the first to give. Beautiful, gentle, understanding, forgiving, and wise beyond her years. Not a soul had ever had a bad thing to say about her. Despite the full-throated claims of people like Padera, Bryn had suspected the stories were too good to be true. She assumed Arya's faults had been sanitized and forgotten. No one could be so perfect. It wasn't possible. Or was it? He looked for you in Rel, Bryn told her. Then we fell into the abyss. Arya nodded, and the woman's expression was like seeing love looking back at her. Gifford won the race. He went faster than any man ever. And he saved everyone. Tears welled in Arya's eyes. I know, my dear. I've heard the tales. And expected nothing less.
Gifford stayed in the abyss because he wouldn't leave Rhone. Sounds like someone we know, Glyndora said, smiling at Arya.
Gifford's mother sniffled as she wiped tears from her cheeks.
He wanted to meet you so very much, Bryn said. He loved you even though he never met you.
If he's his mother's son, Wraith said, he may yet do so.
Bryn wiped her face again.
I feel so stupid. Here I am in this wonderful place, and I keep bawling my eyes out.
She sniffled and looked at the third woman. She appeared about the same age Bryn was when her parents died.
Bryn, Wraith said,
this is my sister, Daedria.
She's been wanting to meet you for a long time now. She's a storyteller.
Nice to meet you.
Bryn nodded to the girl.
I've never met a real keeper, Daedria said. We didn't have one in our village, and certainly not one as important as you.
The girl looked embarrassed and gestured at everyone else.
I'm not like the rest of you. I didn't do anything great to get in here. I didn't earn my place. Wraith invited me.
You can do that? Bryn asked.
The girl nodded.
Of course. How can a person be truly happy if someone they love isn't allowed to be by their side? Alison wouldn't be a paradise if that meant separation from loved ones.
Wraith nodded.
The hard part is getting people to accept that truth. Some people, like my father and brothers, don't understand how it works, so they deny themselves entry. Others, like my mother, aren't ready.
Those who walk in here on their own are the ones who are always here, in a way.
It's hard to explain.
And I was never as good with words as you.
After Bryn's visit to the Abyss, she felt she understood better than he thought. She never would have believed it. But people were their own worst enemies.
Tesh could climb out if he could get past what was weighing him down.
They all could. The problem was they felt they deserved to suffer. Guilt anchored them to the bottom.
We should get going, Glendora interrupted, putting a hand on Daedria's shoulder. She has a long way to go yet, remember?
A shame you couldn't be here on a better day, Arya said, as they began to stroll up the path leading toward the Blue Mountains.
Wraith said it was a bad day too, but I don't understand why, Bryn said.
Arya looked at Wraith, who looked at the Frey.
Because it's storming out, Glendora explained.
Bryn looked up at the clear sky.
Not in here, dear,
the Frey told her.
Not in here. The trip across Alison was lovely, and Bryn lost her concern about storms and why everyone was acting so oddly around her. They weren't telling her everything, or anything for that matter, but watching the four of them laugh, sing, and at times dance had a way of making her feel like there was nothing to worry about. Arya danced the best, performing with fearless abandon. Wraith's sister did cartwheels. Glendora had a beautiful voice for song. Bryn didn't understand the words, but she didn't need to. She couldn't understand the messages in bird songs either. Bryn hadn't imagined Wraith to be a dancer, but he was wonderful. At one point, he took her hands and spun her around until her feet came free of the ground. Joy was air in Alison, ecstasy the grass beneath their feet, and delight the brilliance that shone upon everything. But even surrounded by all of it, Bryn couldn't be carefree. The banquet they feasted on wasn't for her. She was just passing through. And it isn't a good day.
By the time they had crossed the valley and entered the foothills, the reality of leaving started to weigh on her. Alison was a warm home, filled with the light of a crackling hearth, the smell of baking bread, and good friends laughing heartily. But outside that house, a thunderstorm raged. Bryn knew she would soon be forced back into that dreadful tumult. And when she left, she would go alone. During their travels, Bryn discovered that Alison was more sparsely populated than either Rell or Nifril. For a time, she wondered if it was just the five of them, but every now and then she spotted a distant figure walking on a far-off hill. Glendora or Arya would wave, and the distant figure would return the gesture. Bryn should have asked who the strangers were. She was neglecting her keeper duties, but her mind was on the storm. She grew quiet, and the others left her to her thoughts. Bryn realized that each realm of the afterlife was imperfect. Rel was calm, but stale and dull. Nifril was exciting, but also scary, violent, and cruel. While joyful and bright, Alison suffered from the knowledge that the rest of the world remained in pain, a particular remorse tailored for the inhabitants it drew. The world is broken. Both Pyre and the face of Ilan are shattered and in splinters. Bryn thought she could glimpse how the pieces were supposed to go together. Though the universe had been split into scattered shards, she could see how the parts might fit, and could guess at the final shape once it was made whole again. The equally obvious problem was the massive scale of the required restoration. Is it even possible to fix it all? A pretty house appeared along the path, perched on a rise that overlooked fields and, farther down, the sea. The home was small, made mostly of stone, and was topped with a thatched roof. Window boxes held red flowers, and a walkway of cleverly fitted stones serpentined from the road to the door, which was painted bright green and had a half-moon top. They stopped, and Arya knocked. "Who lives here?" Bryn asked. Before Wraith could answer, the door opened, and a beautiful woman looked out at them. She had a luxurious mane of golden hair that reached down to her waist, but her eyes were dark as rich soil. "So, she's arrived at last," the lady said without a hint of surprise. "Please, come in." Bryn couldn't make even a guess at her age. She had a youthful beauty, but the grace of her movements and the confidence in her voice suggested profound wisdom. And for no reason at all, or perhaps all of them at once, Bryn loved her. The lady held the door open and smiled. The others went inside, but as Bryn drew closer, tears filled her eyes once more. By the time she stood before the lady, Bryn was sobbing without knowing why. There was no pain or sadness. The tears were the same as though she'd cried when she found her parents in Rel. But Bryn didn't know this woman. A moment later, she had fallen into the lady's arms. "It's all right," she whispered, brushing the wet hair from Bryn's face. "You'll be fine." Bryn continued to cry. The lady held her patiently as they stood in her doorway. Finally, Bryn found enough voice to ask, "Who are you?" "I'm your mother." Bryn looked up, confused. "All right," the lady smiled in a whimsical way. "I'm your very, very great-grandmother. My name is Mara. I'm the second daughter of Eaton and Ilan." Bryn gasped, shuddered, and felt completely lost. "Should I? I don't know. Should I kneel? I have chairs." She smiled, and to see it was to look full-faced at love. She gestured at the interior of her house, which was what Bryn imagined the perfect home to be. A wood floor, cushioned window seat, bright green shutters that were thrown wide open, soft chairs, and a stone hearth with a steaming pot. Bryn stared in amazement. The painted walls were covered in circles and curving lines of yellow and orange, celestial swirls with stars above them. The others took seats around the hearth. Mara waited for Bryn to do the same. There were plenty of chairs, but she sat on the floor the way she used to at home. Bryn half expected to see her mother at the loom and Moya working the spinning wheel. Sitting cross-legged, she couldn't shake the feeling that this place felt more like her home than the one she'd grown up in. It seemed like the place that her parents, that everyone, had been trying to make. Mara sat beside her. The white gown she wore settled like mist. "I asked the others to bring you by so we could talk," she said. Bryn nodded, trying her best to look serious, but it was hard to concentrate.
This place is just so perfect. This is where everyone should live.
Bryn, you need to focus. I know it's hard to do here, but up that path lies the exit from Pyre and the entrance to the Sacred Grove. When you go through, you'll be returning to Elan.
To the storm,
Bryn whispered.
Yes,
but...
Bryn looked out the open window and saw a bird land on a berry bush.
Couldn't I just...
She stopped before saying more. She wasn't a child, yet she felt like one.
I want to stay here. I wish... But it's more than that. I don't think I can do it.
I'm supposed to go to Estramnadon, but that's the home of the Frey. She glanced at Glindora.
Tek-Chin was supposed to be our guide. He knows the city and the language. There were others with me. All of them heroes. Real heroes. They would be able to see this thing through. But I can't. I'm not even sure anymore why I came at all.
She brushed the hair from her face, feeling the residue of tears on her cheek.
At the time, I said it was because I wanted to help my friend. But I think that wasn't true. I guess I just didn't want to be left out. I didn't want to be the only one who did nothing. But there's a reason why I never did anything. Because I can't do anything. I'm not a hero. I only write about them.
Bryn, Wraith caught her attention. You climbed out of the abyss.
Arya nodded.
No one has ever done that. So, okay, that was hard, but only because I was dragging stuff with me. Once I let go of it, the climb wasn't so difficult.
But you were smart enough to figure that out, Glendora said, and strong enough to do it.
Bryn nodded.
Yeah, okay, sure, I get that, but the rules are different in here, aren't they? Out there, I'm nothing special. And this time I'll be alone. I'm not like the others. All I've done is create a book that only two people can read, and both of them are lost to the abyss. I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. We thought we came to save Suri, but Tressa told me that was a lie. Instead, I'm supposed to get some kind of horn and give it to Nephron. But I don't know where to find such a thing, or even what it looks like. It's about this big, the Frey said, holding her hands about a foot apart.
Just then, the Keeper's mind clicked a piece into place.
The real reason for this trip is to return with something called the Horn of Glindora.
She stared at the Frey, stunned.
Your name is Glindora. It's your horn.
She nodded. I'm the first Fane of my people. And it was given to me, to all, Frey, to keep us from destroying one another through infighting. It's our most sacred relic. But it doesn't look like anything special. To most, it looks like a battered ram's horn. But it has markings on it.
Writing?
The Frey nodded.
No one knows that.
Not yet. Right now, everyone thinks they're just decorative markings. Some might even speculate they're magic runes, like the Orinfar. But in fact, they are words. Words you can read.
How is that possible?
Because you invented the language they're written in.
Bryn should have refuted the idea as being impossible. The horn was obviously ancient, and even if that weren't the case, Bryn had never been on the Frey side of the Nidwalden River. But there was no denying her ability to read the tablets in the Agave that were written by the Ancient One. Trilos had used her language as well.
Or maybe she had used his. The whole thing was confusing, and it was impossible to know how much came from her and what had come from him. She had no idea how any of this was possible. Yet there was no denying it was.
What do the words say?
Bryn asked the question with riveted anticipation. She guessed the writing must contain something wise, or magical, or profound. She was certain the Fane would shake her head, dismiss the question, and say,
It is beyond your understanding, child.
Instead, Glendora began to chuckle.
They are instructions on how to use it,
She put a hand to her mouth and laughed in embarrassment. Ironically, at some point in the future, reading will be common, but the nature of the horn will be forgotten. Strange how these things sometimes work out. Can all of you see the future?
No, Mara said. But the person who wrote on the horn could. He can see everything quite clearly.
Turin, Bryn said.
They all nodded. Until that point, Bryn hadn't realized that a simple rocking of one's head could communicate so much emotion. Each nod was incredibly sad.
Bryn looked down at the patch of light that entered the window and created an elongated, skewed rectangle on the floor. The color was golden, far richer and more vibrant than anything in Alan.
Here, even light on the floor is a wonder. I could spend an eternity staring at it. What a wonderful place this is. I want to stay.
I'm not certain I should do anything that he wants. Bryn blurted out the words that she'd kept inside so long. Like the tears she'd shed on Wraith's shoulder, the confession burst out.
Malcolm,
she looked at Wraith,
told you his name was Turin, but he's also known as Uberlin. Did you know that?
I didn't then, the Durain said. But yes, I've heard the tales.
Given that, I have to wonder whether completing any quest that he initiated makes me complicit with evil. She looked at Mara. Can you tell me?
Mara stood and walked to the window, where she drew the curtains. As she did, the room darkened.
That's why you're here. Why I asked you to be brought to my home.
She crossed to the other window.
It's important that you are well informed, but I should warn you, it's not a pleasant tale. And I can't tell you all of it because I wasn't there for the end.
Mara closed the other set of drapes, and darkness reigned. She resumed her seat near the hearth, where a small fire began to glow. The goddess of mankind sat up straighter than before, and as she did, the others shifted. Apparently, Bryn wasn't the only one interested in the story. Mara placed her hands on her thighs and leaned forward, assuming the posture that all storytellers reserved for their best tales.
Perhaps the technique is inherited, passed down from parent to child for eons. Or have I somehow channeled Mara when reciting the old stories?
Bryn had always felt there was something mystical in the power that keepers had to transport others to different times and places.
Maybe it's a kind of a spell.
Bryn was discovering that magic was far more common than she would have ever believed.
It's not that magic is so rare in everyday life, but perhaps it's just ignored or overlooked. Turin waged the first war upon us, his brothers and sisters.
Mara began in a soft but ominous voice that captured the attention of everyone in the room. Bryn imagined that even the birds outside, those who could hear her, had stopped to listen.
Our father, Eaton, did not approve of what he saw. It confirmed that he had been right. Rather than punish my mother, or us, or Turin, Eaton decided to punish Alluria. In his finite wisdom, he determined that it was she who was at fault for giving Turin eternal life. She was the lawbreaker. So she was the one to face his wrath.
What did he do?
Eaton disowned her.
He turned his face away. Mara clasped her hands together, placing the tips to her mouth. As she did, the last of the remaining light that bled through the material of the drapes and from the other rooms was snuffed, casting them all in darkness.
Alluria cried and begged forgiveness, but Eaton refused to listen. He sealed her in stone, cutting her off from his gifts, rain, warmth, and light.
As they sat in the dark, only a faint glow from the embers of the hearth illuminated their faces. Each stared wide-eyed at Mara. Outside, the birds had stopped singing. The breeze stopped playing with the leaves. The whole of Alison paused as Mara told the tale, and as she did, her voice grew in depth and volume. Turin was unstoppable, and proclaimed himself to be King Great One. His forces, the many who remained loyal to Rex Uberlin, poured out of Erebus, laying siege to each of our cities. His war escalated. He killed Feral first, and made a sport of it. You see, she was the first to defy him after Trilos's death. Turin humiliated Feral before the walls of her own city. Then he made her watch as it burned, and her people were slaughtered. She closed her eyes, and in the ember's light, Bryn saw Mara's pain. Drome was next. Uberlin destroyed him, and while he wasn't as cruel, he killed Drome just the same. By the time Rex Uberlin showed up at my walls, he was tired, so he made my death mercifully quick. I think he regretted it. I believe, yes, even then I was sure, he didn't want to kill me. I was his little sister. But by then he was traveling down a path that had no turns, no way to reverse course. At the time, he didn't know about Aluria's fate. He'd been too busy punishing us. Once all his brothers and sisters were dead and safely imprisoned in Pyre, he turned his attention to what remained of their children, who were fleeing across the sea to the west. While chasing down Feral's people, he came upon the sacred grove and discovered what Eaton had done. That's when Turin challenged his own father. He brought war to the sky itself. Mara stopped. Her hands came down to her lap once more as she stared silently at the floor. After a long pause, Bryn asked, "What happened?" Mara offered a sad smile. "Forever the keeper. I wish I could tell you, my child, but I don't know. I wasn't there. I was dead." Mara gave her a little smirk, like a friendly aunt who was once a very mischievous child. As she did, the room brightened. "For the rest of the tale, you have to go to the source. You must enter the sacred grove." "But you know what happened. I've heard about it. Everyone has. The afterlife is rife with gossip. That's what the dead do. We spread rumors. There is plenty of talk about what we would have done, what should have happened, and what some believe did occur. But we're in here, and it's not possible to separate truth from speculation. It's best that you hear the story from one who was actually there." "Who?" Again, that impish smile formed on Mara's face as she stood and took the effort to open the drapes once more.
"Mara knows how to motivate a keeper, doesn't she?" Wraith said, as light once more filled the homey space.
"Can you at least tell me why it is you have a wonderful place while Feral is in, well, where she is?"
"Nephril isn't a punishment." Mara returned to her seat. "That's like asking why you don't tie your hair back like someone else does, even if you think their choice looks ghastly. To Drome, the world was always this or that, black or white. When we were children, he would stay in the clearing while the rest of us explored the woods. After we came back, he would have a sculpture made out of branches or a little house built from sticks. He was content and didn't need more. Feral was always smart, arrogant, and insecure. She admired her older brothers, but resented them too. She believed they got all the glory. If Turin hadn't invented war, she most certainly would have. To her, Nephril was as near to perfection as she could ask for."
"And you?" Bryn asked. "Don't you hate your brother for what he did?"
Mara stared out the window at a distant point on the horizon. I can't say I'm happy with them, but hate?
She scrunched up her nose and pressed her lips together, shifting them back and forth as she searched for an answer. Since Mara had had so long to contemplate it, Bryn was surprised she didn't just know. Perhaps she had at one time. But Mara had the look of someone re-evaluating. For a time, I did hate him. But for me, hate is difficult. Hate is like holding your hands over your head on a dare. You can do it for a long time, sure, but it does get tiring and bothersome after a while. It's not possible to do much with your hands over your head, and given enough time, you wonder why you are inconveniencing yourself. You question what is to gain, and then you feel just plain silly. When Uberlin reached my walls, I went out to meet him. He didn't look happy. He was supposed to be evil incarnate, a conquering madman, but I only saw my brother. You see, Drome and Feral, being twins, bickered all the time. Because I was the youngest, I was left behind. But sometimes Turin and Trilos would take me adventuring. They were my big brothers, and I loved them. Mara pressed a hand to her lips and sighed. I guess I still do. Doing so makes me mad sometimes, but I can't help it. She wiped her eyes. Turin, or Uberlin by then, had come to kill me, dressed in his shimmering robe that shifted color, and a mantle that had a mind of its own. He held his spear, Nasirabat, and wore a silly-looking crown. He seemed so sad, and for a moment, he was my big brother again. I asked him to spare my people, to let them go. He agreed, and to his credit, he honored that promise. She paused, looking past Bryn again, focusing once more on something too far in the distance to be seen. I would have died anyway, eventually. I only lost a few years. Bryn shook her head. I don't know if I could be so understanding. You, Mara said with a laugh. You have no idea what you are capable of. Not yet. All of that lies beyond the door to the Sacred Grove. It's time you were on your way. Come. With that one word, she ushered them all out of her house and up the stone-fitted path to the road. There, Mara threw out her arms, closed her eyes, and tossed her head back as if basking in the rays of an invisible sun. She took deep breaths, as if needing to rejuvenate herself. Once more, the birds sang, and the breeze blew. Bryn looked up the road, at the stretch she had yet to walk. I'm still not certain I should do this. Rex Uberlin, the great king of the world, the lunatic who fought the sky, has gone through an incredible amount of effort to get you where you are now, Mara told her. He doesn't do anything without a reason. And more than anything, he hates to lose. I understand it's upsetting to feel manipulated, and no one likes to learn they've been lied to. But having the first king on your side does come with benefits. And you should consider this. He knew you'd find out, but he had faith you'd do the right thing. My oldest brother is many things, but stupid isn't one of them. He can't make you continue. You have Eden's key around your neck, and Turin is immortal. If you decided to stay, there's nothing he could do to you. He can't come in here. But know this, Turin entrusted the key to you, and he isn't a trusting person. Malcolm didn't trust me. He gave the key to Tressa. Mara smiled and let her hand drift across the tops of ivy that grew on a trestle alongside the road. Where her palm passed, purple flowers bloomed. The fact that you are here, and you have it, says differently. I know it's difficult to trust him, given what you know, Glendora said. I had it easier than you.
I didn't know anything about the First War when I met him. And he went by the name of Caratacus. But if it helps your decision, know this. He did bring order to my people at a time when it seemed like there was no stopping us from orchestrating our own destruction. He stopped fray-on-fray violence and instilled a system whereby leadership could pass without the death of thousands. I can find no nefarious reasons for him to do that, so, if you ask my opinion, my counsel is to put your trust in him, and know that he has, without question, put his trust in you. He knew you would succeed, even before you were born. But you're not listening. He didn't send me. I, Bryn, Arya said, stopping her. You are the only one that matters. Don't you understand that? This hasn't been about Tressa or Moya or any of the others. They were sent to ensure you made it through, and you have. Bryn shook her head, but couldn't find the words to explain how wrong they all were. They had to be. And despite Mara leading them at a casual pace down the road, Bryn felt rushed, pushed toward a fate that terrified her. Already Mara's house was far behind them, and the road had narrowed to a path and then vanished entirely. Now they walked through a field of grass, swaying with flowers that bowed as they passed. At first, Bryn thought it was just the wind, but that wasn't it. Daisies and goldenrod dipped their heads whenever the group came near. Birds swooped as if to get a better look, and the light that had no source followed them like a friend. If only Tesh were with me. If he could just see this place. If only they knew such a place waited. She sighed, remembering her promise to forget them. Some promises were harder than others to keep, and she doubted she'd ever manage to forget any of them. She was, after all, a keeper.
You won't be alone, Glendora said.
That's right, Wraith added. The greatest of the great awaits you in the sacred grove.
Mara nodded. Eaton gave an exemption from his laws for those who proved themselves deserving of his trust. For them, death has no hold. They alone have the freedom to go where they will, to do as they please. Sadly, only one has been found worthy.
I heard about that,
Bryn nodded. Fenelea said there are only two in the sacred grove, Aluria and her guardian.
That's our understanding as well, Mara said.
And with the exception of brief absences, that hero has chosen to spend eternity in the sacred grove, next to Aluria. By all accounts, the grove was the pinnacle of all. Average people went to Rel. The ambitious were awarded with Nifril, and the true heroes came to Alison. Given that, Bryn wondered what it would be like in the place where the greatest of all heroes dwelled. Bryn figured it had to be a place of even greater reward. And yet, can there be a better place than this? What can surpass Alison?
She also began to speculate about the great hero whom Eaton had found worthy. She'd come across every person of great renown, the first Fane of the Frey, Garth of Odion, Atella, Wraith, Midian, Fenelaus, Arya, and four of the five Asira, including the goddess of mankind. None of them had earned the right.
Who is it?
I believe you're about to find out. Wraith stopped and pointed at a small pool.
Of course it's a pool. A dark, sinister pool. And I bet it's the only one of its ilk in all of Alison. You can do this.
Mara grinned at her. You've entered my realm dressed as a Belgric Glungrian warrior and shining like a star. You, Bryn of Daldren, Bryn of the Book, conqueror of the Abyss, holder of the Key of Eton, and, whether you like it or not, champion of the First King, Rex Uberlin. You are greater than you think.
Have faith, Bryn, Glendora said. Remember,
I, too, have been where you are now, putting your trust into his hands. I was sitting on the bank of the River Gan, crying so hard I couldn't finish weaving the basket I was working on when he found me. He told me that if I trusted him, together we could save my people, and eventually, the world. He made good on his first promise, and I believe he is working through you to fulfill the second. I witnessed miracles. My people were saved. I don't believe he's going to destroy them now. Bryn nodded. There's no getting out of this. If nothing else, I must see what lies beyond. She faced the pool and gritted her teeth. Thank you, Bryn said. One by one, they each hugged her. Wraith was the last.
You'll do fine, he whispered in her ear. You're the only one who doesn't know that.
She squeezed him back. Persephone loves you. You know that, right?
Yes. She talks to me all the time.
Bryn stared at him for a moment, unsure what he meant.
Go on. Become the hero we all know you to be.
Bryn nodded and walked forward, wading into the pool. As the water rose to her chest, she thought of all those she had left behind, and once more, her last thought was of Tesh.
Chapter 12. Venlin.
I have long wondered about Mwanderlei and why he did it. When presented with such a terrible choice, why did he take that path? Was it fame? Was it fear? Or was it something else entirely?
The Book of Bryn.
Mwanderlei had first entered the Erinthian as a junior counselor, then as a senior member of the Aquila, and later as an ex-counselor. Now he arrived in the ancient chamber as a potential traitor. Macaretta was at his side, and the sense of déjà vu was thick in the air. Together they stood in the doorway, bathed in the warm glow of the late-night braziers. Mwanderlei had never been there at night. He turned back and saw how the moon cast a cold light on the snow-covered marble outside the entrance. Across the valley, and standing on its own hill, was the palace, bathed in shadow. The Erinthian had supposedly been built at the same elevation as the Talwara, a fact that Mwanderlei disputed. Now, the equality seemed deserved. It will be fine, Macaretta whispered in his ear. You'll see. He wanted to believe her, but she'd lied before. No, that wasn't right. She simply hadn't told him everything. And in a way, each of them had been led astray, both of them victims. Yet in the aftermath, they lived very different lives. While he slept in the Talwara and ate at banquets, she lived on scraps and slept in the forest, under bridges, and in cellars. Macaretta had filled him in on the tragedy that had been her life since the failed rebellion. She hadn't asked for pity, hadn't been melodramatic about any of it. She spoke openly of her hunger-filled days, pretending to be a Gwaedrae, when she ate fly-covered trash and dressed in rags, because she was too scared to use the art for fear it might be detected. She had almost died more than once. She didn't talk much about those times, just said she took desperate chances. The most dangerous moment was when she revealed herself to someone she hoped might be sympathetic. That had been terrifying, because she knew her life was on the line. Macaretta believed the odds were against her, but felt she had no choice. The next step would be suicide, so she had one chance in three to survive. She would either be rescued, turned in, or die by her own hand. Thankfully, she won that bet. Macaretta never said who the mysterious benefactor was, but he guessed he was about to meet her patron. Mwanderlei imagined her alone on the streets, hiding, cowering, and eating whatever she'd hastily ripped from a filthy compost pile. He wished she had come to him sooner. He wanted it to be him that she came to when making that desperate gamble. He would have liked to be the one to wash the dirt from her face and make it perfect again. At least she had eventually come to him. That night, Wanderley wore his heavy black cloak. Normally it hung in the back of his closet because he never went out when it was this cold. It became his final defense against the bitterest of days. The wool was four layers thick and cinched tightly with a leather belt. He'd pulled its large hood up, making a tiny cave for his head. Even as cold as it was, snow was still possible, and it swirled around them. His body shook, his eyes watered, and his cheeks burned from the wind, but his hand was sweaty where it touched hers. Wanderley was surprised to see so many people inside. He'd anticipated only four or five unknown faces, perhaps another renegade Myrilith who had also escaped the Fane's retribution. He certainly didn't expect what he found. Nearly the entire Aquila had gathered. Four councillors, Nanagal of the Elwyn, Volhoric of the Umalin, Haemon of the Gwaedrae, and Osla, newly appointed as senior councillor of the Ascendoir, were in their usual seats. Family and some friends of the Aquila sat behind them in the lower tier, but the junior councillors were absent. In the centre of the chamber, in what was supposed to be the Fane seat, but was clearly her chair, sat Curator Imali, representative of the Nilnyid. Vidar of the Myrilith was the only seat left vacant. He was still at Avimpartha, teaching the artists on the frontier how to conjure dragons. The assembly's whispered conversation halted the moment Macaretta led Wanderley in. Everyone in the chamber rose and applauded. Wanderley stopped short at the sight. The Aquila only did that when the Fane entered. Macaretta led him to Vidar's seat, and he realized he was meant to take his place as a representative of the Myrilith, making this as complete an Aquila meeting as possible, without the always absent Instaria. Everyone sat when he did. Macaretta took the junior councillor's position that she'd occupied years ago for those few minutes before she attacked Imali. He watched the curator, expecting an explosion of outrage. What she did was even more shocking. Imali smiled approvingly and bowed respectfully toward Macaretta. "We are complete," Imali announced. Her voice was as it had always been, making the proceedings on that dark winter's night sound official and untainted. Still, Wanderley wondered if she wasn't speaking just a tad quieter than she usually did in the light of day. "Thank you, Wanderley, for coming. I realize, we all do, that this couldn't have been an easy decision or a casual walk. The weather does fit the proceedings, does it not?" She stood up and faced them, clasping her hands before her in a solemn pose. "All of us braved the bitter storm and gathered here this night because we have come to realize that something is fatally wrong with our world." She tilted her head back and gestured at the ceiling and the paintings of Glyndora Fane and Caraticus. "Out of a great disaster, my great-great-grandmother led our people to this place to create a better life. In Glyndora's youth, Frey fought Frey, and did so with great zeal. Death and destruction was our existence until Caraticus found her weaving baskets on the bank of a small creek. The last virtuous Frey, he called her. She, who had no desire to rule, was the one he anointed to be the first Fane of our people, the one he knew could lead us out of the darkness and into a new future of peace. It is in this spirit that we are gathered here tonight." Imali walked around her chair and gripped the back of it with both hands, speaking to them over its top. "To fill this seat, a Nilnyid was chosen, not a powerful Instaria warrior,
not even a pious Umalin, but a lowly basket weaver from the crafters' tribe. The lowest of us was understood to be the best choice because she had no vanity, no sense of superiority. Imali revealed an inner humour that spilled onto her lips in a modest smile, except in her basket weaving, about which I was told she was unbearably conceited. In a normal meeting of the Aquila, this bit of humour might have elicited laughter. That night, the best it raised was appreciative smiles. Imali let her arms fall away from the chair. The true talent and success of Glendora was wholly due to her ability to see all Frey as her family. Her fairness and understanding are what allowed her to establish Estramnadon and this council. She understood that she needed help to govern. More recent Fanes have forgotten that. The ones who never had the benefit of having woven baskets. The curator moved around to the front of her chair. The spirit of Glendora Fane no longer sits on the forest throne. As a result, our people face annihilation. We, who once ruled the known world, have been brought low out of arrogance, pride, and our own crippling traditions. She said this while looking at Volhoric. The high priest frowned and shifted uneasily in his seat. The laws Caraticus brought to us, along with the divine horn, were given and accepted as a means to save us from ourselves. Now those very laws may be our undoing. Blind adherence is foolhardy at best, and at this point, suicidal. She clapped her hands against her thighs. Fane Lothian is killing us first. He refused to allow the Instaria to have a voice in this august body. He maintained the entire tribe's banishment and killed their leader in a despicable manner. This was a message not just to the Instaria, but to all of us. The Fane wanted to demonstrate that the spirit of Glendora Fane was dead. Her horn no longer needed to be blown, for only the Myrleaf would sit on that woody throne from now on. Out of his arrogance, he elevated his tribe above all others, sowing mistrust and dissent. When the runes discovered that the Myrleaf were not gods, he sought to destroy them. She sighed, bowed her head, and then lifted it to address those assembled. Well, that didn't work out so well, did it? Everyone here knows the pain of losing someone who died during Lothian's needless war with the runes. There was a time, not so long ago, when death was a stranger, a rare and bewildering visitor. Now it lingers in every shadow, every song unsung, each silenced set of footsteps. We all sat here and listened, as Fane Lothian told us how the death of Amadea would save us. Instead, she died in vain. She died for nothing, and the blood was on his own hands. Now our Fane has ordered Myrleaf families to be ripped apart. To create his dragons, he is forcing mothers to kill their children, husbands to execute their wives, and friends to kill friends. What kind of insanity condones the murder of the ones we love? The enemy that threatens to destroy us is not being held at bay on the banks of the Nidwaldon. He sits on the forest throne. She sighed again, and once more clasped her hands before her. We can be foolhardy, or we can be as brave as a basket weaver. Imali sat down, and a silence allowed the sound of the winter wind to enter the chamber. Then Macareta stood up. You'll need a Myrleaf to fight Myrleaf, she said, and everyone knows how I feel about the Fane. I'll do whatever is needed, but I don't think I can handle Sine, Sile, and Lothian by myself. Imali appeared to consider this, and Mundalay was lost in the surreality of the discussion. They really mean to do it,
This isn't speculation.
A figure Montalais hadn't noticed, apparently no one had, rose from where he sat in the balcony and stepped into the light near the rail. Like all of them, he wore a dark winter coat, this one with silver trim. Reaching the rail, he drew back his hood. At the sight of Vasek's face, Mondelez's breath caught in his throat.
We're all dead. The Master of Secrets has finally found Margareta, and with her, a whole new nest of traitors.
Vasek made a subtle coughing sound to gain everyone's attention. Heads turned. Mondelez expected there would be cries, maybe a few would try to flee. But he knew it would do them no good. Vasek was too smart for that. The Arenthian would already be surrounded. Sine, and who knew how many others, would be waiting. Montalais remembered Vasek questioning him.
I was wondering if you'd had contact with, or have heard about any resurgence of, the Grey Cloaks.
Perhaps Vasek had suspected him this whole time, and had been following his movements and Macaretta's.
To Montalais's surprise, no one attempted to flee. They didn't even appear worried.
Shock. That's what's going on. It has to be.
She's right, Vasek said. Margareta will need help. Someone who can get close. Someone the Fane won't expect. Would never expect.
Vasek looked at him then.
The one to kill Lothian must be the prince.
Heads turned to Mwandale, who sat lost in an unimaginable world. The whole of the Aquila were in on the conspiracy. Vasek, too. Mondelez felt Margareta's hand on his. It gave him strength. It gave him courage. He stood up, slowly feeling the weight of his heavy cloak. He didn't know what he would say until the words came out.
He's my father.
He's a tyrant,
Vasek replied, his voice falling down from above with an unaccustomed emotion and surprising authority.
And he'll bring forth the end of us all.
Master of Secrets was a title Mondelez had always assumed meant that Vasek knew the private dealings of everyone else. While that might be true, the greater truth was that Vasek was the master of his own secrets.
He's also a Frey, Mondelez said. If I were to...
He couldn't bring himself to say it.
If I did this, I would break Feral's law.
He saw Emali look to Volhoric, who stood with as much reluctance as Mondelez had.
As high priest of the Umalin tribe and spiritual leader of the peoples of Erevan, I can assure you that ending Lothian's reign as Fane will be sanctioned by Lord Feral. Through his actions, your father has abdicated his role as Fane, broken his covenant with his people and our god. By murdering Amidea without just cause and forcing others to kill their loved ones, he has cast himself out of the protection afforded by Feral's law. You will not anger Feral by taking this action, because in the eyes of our Lord Feral, you will be executing an outlaw. There you have it,
Hemon of the Guaidri proclaimed. Feral's blessing, not his wrath, will be upon you.
Emali spoke then.
This is a heroic act.
And with Lothian removed, you would receive the throne. I propose that if you do this great service to our people, the least we can offer in return is to guarantee no challenger will be put forth. You will receive the throne unopposed. Do we all agree?
Each of the senior counselors responded with a communal,
Aye.
Mondelez was still standing, still holding Macaretta's hand, still thinking.
There is one more thing I should mention, Emali said casually from her seat,
where she leaned on one of the arms, her legs crossed beneath her winter cloak.
A secret that I suspect even Vasek isn't aware of, because everyone else here has faithfully kept it for years, as is our charge under the law. I'll break that covenant now because, as curator, I feel this situation warrants it. And because there's no sense in protecting one who is already dead.
She focused on Wanderlei.
When your grandmother Fenelaus died, I, as curator, and Volhoric as conservator, agreed that the Instaria leader, Zephyron, would be given the opportunity to challenge your father. We did this because we were uncomfortable that an entire tribe of the Frey was being denied a voice in this chamber, and thus a voice in the ear of their fane. We felt this was Fairol's will. The result wasn't what we expected.
With all due respect, Wanderlei said, I already know all this. I was there. I saw the fight.
True, but you don't know what no one but the voting members knew.
Which was?
There was another applicant who was denied.
Wanderlei shook his head.
Who?
Grindel of the Myrilith.
Wanderlei stared in disbelief. He wanted to say it was a lie, but he knew better because he remembered Grindel's words to him during their trip to Dal Ren. I know it's wrong for me to say this, but sometimes I honestly wish some tragedy might befall your father. Not anything fatal, of course, just something rendering him unable to rule so that you could take over. I know that sounds terrible, but I fear your father isn't suited to guide us into the future. His rule will lead to disaster. Trust me, Wanderlei. Your father's reign will threaten our whole way of life.
Wanderlei now saw that those words had not been idle musings. At the time Grindel had said them, he had already tried to challenge the Fane.
Ever wise, Grindel spoke of the danger your father posed to our people, Imali said. Sadly, this body did not fully appreciate his fears. If only we had listened. Instead, we chose to go with an Instaria challenger because there were concerns that continued rule by the Myrilith tribe would forever be the norm. So, we avoided pitting two members of the same tribe against each other. We didn't want to give the impression to the other tribes that the challenge was obsolete. We were wrong. Our judgment was clouded, and we denied the candidate. As a result, our people have suffered. If you are willing to step forward, you can correct our error. I'm sure I speak for everyone here when I say it is you who should rule. You proved your bravery when saving the Arenthian. You were tested at the Battle of Granford, and it is you who is the worthy successor of Fenelaus's legacy. While Grindel would have been a better choice than Lothian, it is you who has always been the best choice. We look to you, Wanderlei, to save our people.
The room erupted in applause and shouts of, "Hear, hear!" All the senior members were on their feet, expressing full-throated agreement.
You won't be alone, Akareta said, squeezing his hand. I'll protect you from any threats from Lothian's bodyguards. I'm already soulless, and I swear I'll kill anyone who tries to hurt you.
So then, Wanderlei began while looking around. It's the unanimous will of the Aquila that I do this?
Heads continued to nod, but Amali shook her head.
No, it is not our will, Wanderlei. We do not come to you with a decree, nor a petition. Or recommendation. This is no council of advice.
Imali stood up, and with the effort that age required, she took hold of the arm of the chair and knelt in the center of the Arinthian. As she did, the others followed her lead, each taking a knee.
We, the Aquila, Imali said, we plead to you. For the good of our people, for our very survival, we beg you to save us.
Everyone else had left the Arenthian. The last brazier, the one behind Volhoric's seat, was almost out.
leaving Wanderlei and Macaretta in the single flicker of a lonesome flame. Wanderlei didn't want to leave. He would have to return to the palace, back to his father's house, to the home of the Fane he now planned to kill. And I will have to leave Macaretta. Having reunited with her, he could no longer bear it when they were apart. He didn't know how he could have been so oblivious to someone who was now as necessary as water and air. How have I lived all these years without her? The answer was obvious. I didn't. He imagined this was how birds felt the first time they flew. "Do you think I'll make a good Fane?" Wanderlei asked. They were still holding hands, huddled close against the cold, his arm around her waist, her head on his shoulder. Outside, the snowstorm still raged, wind blowing with a hurried violence. Yet in the Orinthian, they were safely hidden and protected from the blowing snow, a pair of mice below the frost line. "Think? No, I know. You'll be a legend." She pointed at the ceiling. "Your face will be up there."
"Think so?"
"Absolutely. And it will be nice to see someone handsome on that ceiling for a change." She giggled, a child's laugh. He rubbed the back of her fingers with his thumb, feeling how thin and delicate they were. "So, you think I'm handsome?" "Of course. I thought you knew that." He shrugged. "I hoped. I wished. Wish granted." She threw up a hand, as if tossing something invisible in the air. "Can you do that? Grant wishes?" She raised her head and looked at him with a serious, suggestive flash of her eyes. "Try me." Just then, the brazier blew out, leaving them in darkness. Wanderlei leaned in and kissed her. He didn't know what to expect. He didn't think she would pull away, but she might. Still, a person who is about to commit regicide and patricide at the same time shouldn't be afraid of stealing a kiss in the dark. She didn't pull away. Instead, she pressed against him and tilted her head slightly so their noses didn't collide. He felt her hands, hot and moist, pressing on either side of his head. Her palms warmed his cheeks, holding him there as her lips parted. It felt as if she stole his breath, that she was sucking the air from his lungs. He couldn't breathe, didn't want to. His eyes were closed, his heart pounding when he wrapped his arms around her waist and drew her close. So much clothing lay between them, so many folds. She was in there somewhere. He felt with pressing fingers, which he used to explore in a manner as violent as the storm and soft as a sigh. "You're shaking," she said after drawing her lips away, concern in her tone. "Are you cold?" "Not even slightly." He didn't like that she knew he was trembling. That didn't strike him as brave. So he said, "When I'm Fane, I'll pardon you."